Welcome to Cafe of Delights, conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. We are at the precipice of one of the most exciting evolutions in human history. From science to spirituality, culture, arts, cutting-edge psychotherapies, new economies, and more. We will explore how to create a world where all can thrive. In a series of riveting interviews, you'll have the opportunity to hear from those that are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. Join me, your host and author of the book Money Come Dance With Me, Gail West, to be inspired, delighted, and filled with hope for a new reality. Cafe of Delights starts now. Hello and good morning wherever you are. It's morning here in California. I am so excited to have Paul Bourne as my guest today. And Paul believes in the power of community, which is at the heart of Paul's work and life. Paul works with leaders and communities embarking on large-scale community change initiatives. He is a coach, consultant, and community conversations facilitator in support of breakthrough community change. Founder of BE Community and co-founder of Tamarack Institute and Vibrant Communities, Paul is a social innovator, teacher, and practitioner. He is the author of 5 books and a popular speaker at events and workshops. Welcome, Paul. So happy to have you.
Thanks, Gail. Glad to be here all the way from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada.
Okay. So you are, what time zone are you then?
We're Eastern, so it's 1 o'clock here.
Okay, then. So I ask everyone the same questions, and that is, what brings you hope at this time, and what brings you delight, since this is the Cafe of Delights?
Nice. Well, why don't we start with delight? And you've got this lovely background that, as I was showing you a number of them, you saw it. This is a Lake Ontario. It's a place called Pelee Island, or Point Pelee, which is the southernmost point in Canada. And it's just up by Detroit. So if people are kind of thinking about where this is. And, you know, the delight is in the joy that is all around. And whether it's the joy of family, whether it's the joy of nature, whether it is we're going to a lovely concert this weekend that has been specially written about water, one of our most precious resources. And like, you know, honestly, Gail, my wife often will introduce me. She'll say, this is Paul, my husband. And some people see the world through a cup that is half empty. Some see it as half full. And he mostly sees it as overflowing.
Oh, I love it.
And
love
most it. Days that just pisses me off because he's exhausting. So I tone that down a little bit. And okay. But it is a true, for me, it really is. I sign off almost every email with the words, much joy.
Wow.
Hope is another interesting one, you know. I'm a big believer in hope, though I've been criticized for that. People feeling that hope is deterring people from, it's kind of a, it's kind of a placebo, or it takes us away from acting. And I don't believe that. I believe I've been working in the area of poverty reduction for many, many years. And when I see people losing hope, that to me is true poverty.
Well, that's,
it doesn't matter how much money you have, if you've lost hope in the future. And hope in the future to me is a little bit like the word leadership. For me, the definition of leadership is having a vision for the future and taking ownership of that vision.
Right. Yeah.
And in a sense, that's hope. Having hope in the future and taking ownership of that hope. And so as an optimist, there's a number of things. I know we're going to talk somewhat about poverty today.
Yeah.
And I've been working at that almost all my adult life. I grew up in poverty, though I grew up on a farm, so I didn't really know I was living in poverty. You know, it's interesting because when I started this work 20 years ago with a deliberate effort to bring all of our cities in Canada into a consensus about reducing poverty, and then all of our provinces, so in the US, that would be your states, and our federal government. And that took us about 12 years to create that unified voice where every province, every city, every major city, and middle city, and the federal government had a plan. When we started this work, we were at 16% poverty, and we're now down at 7.2%.
Wow.
That means 16% of the population was poor when we started, and today we're at 7.2%. My belief is that we are going to get down below 5%. There's some variables, but it's very close because right now we're in the final, we've had the final reading, and now we just to bring it into law, which is a guaranteed income supplement for people who are disabled. When we did that for seniors, we eliminated seniors' poverty in Canada. Now we're going to eliminate disability poverty. And there's a whole group of people working on similar type initiatives for the working poor. So if we can eliminate disability poverty and working poor poverty, we will get ourselves down to around 4% poverty in Canada.
Wow.
And at that point, I've said it's no longer poverty. It's now we should actually move the whole folder into health and healthcare because that's our last 4%. And maybe the disability fund, but you know, I often say there's two kinds of poverty. One's economic poverty and one's health poverty. And health poverty are the things that keep us from being able to be active participants in the economy, or even to be able to have to be resilient enough to not be in poverty. And so I think once we get to 4%, Canada will just do a guaranteed income supplement and we will end it. We will
Well,
end economic poverty in Canada, and really have shored up everyone in health poverty. It's amazing hope for
yeah,
me.
it's
And it's my life's work. I worked at it systemically. Our motto has always been, we want less poor, not better poor. This isn't about making the lives of poor a little bit better. This is about a society, a country, a city being better for all of us if we eliminate poverty. It's not just good for the people who are poor, it's good for all of us. Anyway, I could go on forever and ever.
Yeah, so I'm
You have questions?
curious, like I read your bio, which is so fascinating. So you were talking about growing up poor and then the chicken thing, which is fascinating, and that you were raising chickens at 17, and so you were this entrepreneur, and then you started working on, I'd like to know a little bit of the backstory of how poverty became such a big issue for you. And like how you've been able to mobilize so many communities and the country as a whole to care about people in a way that we don't have so much in the States.
Though we're starting to work a lot in the US as well. So
So it's
there's a lot of
exciting.
people there and incredibly talented people in the US and caring people as well. Okay, so it's an interesting story because mom and dad came here in 49 after the war. They were living in the Ukraine. They were kind of a cloistered group of Mennonites that Catherine the Great had invited into the Ukraine a couple of hundred years ago. And they were farmers and they lived very much a cloistered life. But when communism came, their way of life changed completely. And then under Stalin, he was just a ruthless individual. And both of my grandfathers had been executed
Wow.
during that time. And so we were refugees and we came into Canada in 49 together with hundreds and hundreds of other Mennonites at the time. And we settled in a little place called Abbotsford, British Columbia, just near Seattle. And we had to heal. And we all were farmers, so we bought little farms. We had a little 5-acre farm, you know, and we raised chickens and raspberries. And as we were doing that, you know, we were trying to figure out who we were as a people. I didn't really have much of a life outside of the church and my home. I think we were afraid of integrating. I spoke German when I went to grade one.
Wow.
Instead of English. And yet it was, you know, when I go do my lifeline, I always draw that as a green line.
Oh, cool.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
A beautiful time in my life. I had a lovely childhood. And yeah, and we worked hard and we had a really strong sense of community. And there was kind of a hive mind mentality. So, you know, we'd go to church three, sometimes four times a week. And mostly we didn't do church. We just ate. People would cook and we'd play games. And this was our friends. All our cousins were there too, right? You know, so we, you know, but then they would ask, right? They would ask the question, what is, you know, this sense of what we knew together, right? So we would learn together. So someone would say, after the sermon was done and they were having coffee downstairs in the basement of the church, and they would ask, well, my raspberries aren't doing very good. What should I do? My chickens need this. What should I do? My garden is, this is happening. And so we learned from each other. And that was so incredible. And we cared for each other in all these different ways. That's why I call it the hive mind, right? We kind of grew out of our fear and we learned to become Canadian.
Wow.
And it was a marvelous experience overall. And through that, things started to get better for us. And like you said, when I was 17, I 16, actually, the day I got my driver's license, I started my own company. And
that's wild.
All the farmers, almost all of us, we were like the raspberry capital and the egg capital of Canada. And so I specialized in moving layer hens from one barn to the other. There was big, it's obviously it was big factory farming by then. And I hired all my friends. I had at one point 82 employees, and we would go in and move all these chickens. And I charged by the bird and had a guarantee back that it was so funny. I had a 100% satisfaction guarantee. I called it go to bed guarantee. So the farmer could go to bed. We would do all the work, because it all had to be done at night. And when he woke up in the morning, or she woke up in the morning, everything would be perfect. And I dominated the industry very quickly. That's why I grew so quickly with all these employees. Made much more money back then than I do now. And it was wonderful. But then at around the age 19, I decided that, done that, been there, done that. And I had this calling, and I don't know exactly sure what it was. Maybe it was more around social good, but I went on to become a minister. I did that for a couple of years, and my rector there at the seminary said, "Paul, I think this isn't the right job for you. You like sin too much." So I said, "Well, that's interesting.
Okay, then.
It's not a very good job fit, is it?" So anyway, I joke, and then, but I had been studying liberation theology.
Okay.
And was so attracted to it for some reason. It just so resonated with me. And that's basically what liberation theology is, of God's preference for the poor.
Okay.
And I left and went into social development work. I knew business. So this charity had 5 businesses, and they were all bankrupt, and they had me take them over. And I made them all profitable. With volunteers and people who were disabled and people who were struggling in life. That's what these businesses were for. and we turned them into profitable, very profitable businesses. And that's kind of how the story started. And from there, I moved into developing another agency. I moved to Waterloo to finish a degree. For 1 year, met Marlene. We got married. I started another agency here called the Community Opportunities Development Association. We soon had 100 employees. We started over 1,200 small businesses for low-income people, and put thousands and thousands of people back to work. Anyway, lots of stuff that we would do through all of that, and eventually got into the idea of systems change. Time for one quick story.
We have 1 minute before we take a break, so let's. I'm just struck by kind of this golden thread that's run throughout your life and how you've been guided to do what you're doing, and this wisdom that you bring to the world, and your ability to transform anything into money, but money for good.
I love money. I love making money. I love making. We can talk more about that.
Yeah, so I'd love to, because my thing is that we have to transform money from being stuck in this matrix of domination and greed to collaboration and generosity. And that's what you're doing, this collaborative, generous, expansive world that allows money to be an agent for good. It's so powerful.
Maybe when we come back from the break, let's I'll tell you a quick story of the transformational moment for me, and then we can talk more about money.
I'd love it. So this is Cafe of Delights. I'm your host, Gail West, and we will be back in a minute.
Imagine if you were truly flourishing, how would your financial expansion impact the world? Author of Money Come Dance With Me, Gail West is an internationally known speaker, creative catalyst, and business intuitive at Success with Soul. Work with Gail to create a new relationship with money as your friend. Link the soul of your business to the business of your soul with programs like Sacred Money Mastery, Akashic Records of the Soul, and more. To receive a healing money meditation, go to successwithsoul.com today.
Cafe of Delight. Conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. Tune into TransformationTalkRadio.com every second and fourth Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific. We are at the precipice of one of the most exciting evolutions in human history. On Cafe of Delights, you will hear from those that are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. For more information on hope for a new reality, visit Gail West at SuccessWithSoul.com. And hello, you are back on Cafe of Delights with Gail West. And my host today is Paul Bourne, who's been amazing guy, who's been helping to reduce poverty. He's got a wonderful story, and he's got a quick story he's going to talk to us about. And then we're going to talk about money and how we can change the paradigm. So Paul, take it away.
Lovely. Well, you know, I was just sharing with you kind of a little bit about our history and the work we did at the Community Opportunities Development Association. And I had a transformational moment that took me into the next 20 years of my life. And this is where we've been doing this transformational work that is ending poverty in Canada. So the United Nations approached us and asked us if we were interested in being named one of the 40 best practices in the world. And this was from Nairobi. Nicholas Yu was the head of the UN there, and it was the Habitat work looking at better cities. And of course, we were honored. And once our community knew, they threw a big party. It was around 400 people there. And of course, I had to go. I was executive director, and I had to go up and accept the award. So there was this whole program ahead of time, but I was at the very end of the program, and they brought me up and asked me to speak. And I said, you know, I find it really interesting that we're being recognized today. And on the one hand, it makes a lot of sense, because we have, you know, we've started 1,200 small businesses, and they've over 80% have survived longer than 5 years. And in normal, it's less than 50, maybe 40% of businesses make it 5 years. Yeah. And we had buying clubs, and we had our own bank. We had everything, right? It was an amazing structure that we had created, cooperative kind of sense. We had a hit team that when a plant went down, and this was free trade between Canada and the US, so many American companies were moving back to the US and closing in Canada. And our hit team had an unprecedented 98% placement rate. 98% of the workers that lost their jobs, we would help them get new jobs. And again, just dominated the industry. That we had no competition within 2 years. And we were a charity. So it's very interesting to be working like a business and thinking about business, but being a charity in that regard. But, you know, there was one factor, and this is what I said. I said, I find it so interesting that we're being recognized today as one of the 40 best practices in the world. Do you realize that for the 10 years that you're judging us, that poverty has actually gone up by 5% in our community? Last I heard, if you're a corporate executive and you lose 5% of your shareholders' wealth, right? So we're a community organization, by far the largest one working at poverty reduction in our community, and poverty gets worse on our watch. I said, most CEOs that lose company wealth, like we lost community wealth, get fired, not recognized. So I said, with all due respect in front of 400 people, I don't think we should be accepting this award today, and you should probably fire me. And I walked off the stage.
Oh my God.
It didn't go over so well.
No. I can imagine not.
And yet in the next 6 months, the corporate sector, we took no government money, gave me millions of dollars to start an initiative that I called Opportunities 2000 of 1996. We were 4 years away from the millennium, and our goal was to create the lowest level of poverty in Canada in our hometown.
And we rallied
everyone, the corporate sector, the top executives, the top banks, all the top government people, all of people. And then we matched them up with people living in poverty, and we ran a four-year campaign like you've never seen before.
Wow.
And we didn't just help the poor. We started to figure out how to end poverty. And then when that was done, a philanthropist came to me and said, Paul, now we got to take this across Canada. Don't worry about money. Any money that you need will be there for you as long as you need it. You just tell me and I will be there. He became chair of the board. We started the Tamarack Institute. His goal was to end poverty in Canada, and I was there for 20 years. Then the McConnell family came in, and the big anonymous donor family came in. Suncor Oil came in, and we started to create the mechanisms and structures not only to end poverty, but now we're using the same methodology to deepen citizenship and community called Deepening Community, based on my book, Deepening Community, Finding Joy Together in Chaotic Times. We've just started one on climate change. We've now in that one, we're 31 and 19. Yeah, that's 50 cities there are networked. And we just did one on communities building youth futures for middle cities that are losing a lot of their young people. They're all using the same methodology to develop community plans that are based on a very specific way of working called collective impact, or in other words, you know, and I've documented much of this in my latest book, Breakthrough mm-hmm. Community Change. The methodology has been documented there. And that's our story. That's our story of building an organization coming from growing up in a very poor community and then figuring it out. And just to make the transition for you into money, we were so lucky all the way through all of this work. And it was this philanthropist that came with all this money and told us we didn't need it. Well, we didn't. We didn't need much of his money. We raised our own. I started two companies of my own inside the charity, consulting company and a training company. Mm-hmm. And that basically funded 64% of our operations came from that. And when I left Tamarack just last year, we had $5 million of profits in the bank. So it just shows you that we've had this unbelievable luck of always having more money than we needed. So let's open with that.
Yeah, and what's the, I want to say your keys to the kingdom. There's got to be so many people go, how do you do it? How do you do it? So maybe it's mindset and then some mindset and some luck, but I don't feel luck. Luck comes from taking action, basically. And so when you think about, you said you love money. Yeah.
I do.
Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know.
Religious people go, money is really bad. It's like you can't have it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not part of the Mennonite community, but it's part of, and I think that's when we keep money hostage and say it's bad, we do keep it hostage.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you hear a bit of noise in the background here, I can't mute because I'm talking, but we're actually moving our house today. Anyway, I apologize for that, but just think of it as ambiance in the background.
I can't hear it. Not to worry.
Lovely. You know, I don't know what it was, but you know, here you got to think, I'm an immigrant kid. I barely know English. And my dad's got to do taxes at tax time. I'm like 7 or 8 years old. And I take the tax tables to bed with me. Don't know why. And I'm reading the tax guide so I can do my taxes for my dad. You know, I can barely read, huh? But I was so interested in that. And my dad would always talk to us. I always knew exactly how much the farm was making. He worked out as well. I knew exactly how much he was making. There was just this openness about money.
Wow.
In our family. And we didn't have a lot, but we never thought of it as not having a lot. We always thought about making enough.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to make enough, right? And eventually our investments did well. And then, you know, we started buying other farms and fixing them up and flipping them and then other real estate. And life just became much easier over time. And it wasn't just us, our whole community thrived in that similar way,
mm-hmm.
right? Our little church community I was talking about earlier, about 400 families. And so, and then, you know, I had an uncle who is a very wealthy developer, in California and in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was a mentor for me. And so that's why when I was 16, I started my own company and I was going to be a millionaire by 21. I was well on the way, you know, but I never feared money and I still don't fear it. My dad had this saying, it's not how much we make, it's how much we spend. I love that. That has been my driving force in life. It's mm-hmm. not about being cheap in not spending it, but what it meant for us as a family is it meant that we have to guard our wants.
Mm-hmm.
We were well attuned to our needs. We knew our needs,
right?
But we were really needing to think about our wants. And give you an example how this played out with my own kids. My youngest son, when he was 12, came to me and he was distraught. All of his friends had cell phones, but he didn't have one, right? And I said, no way, you're not getting a cell phone until you're 16, right? And he argued with me and we had a lovely relationship. So we argued with laughter. And then I said, okay, Michael, here's the deal. You can have a phone, but tell me how much it costs. And so we figured out that all the costs, including running it for 1 year, would be $300. And I said, okay, so now I'm going to pay you $15 an hour. And you have to do 20 hours of work that are outside of your chores at home. And so he said, oh, okay, I can do that. It's only 20 hours. So of course, he was so young, I had to do all of them with him. But we cleaned mm-hmm. eave troughs, we fixed things, we painted things, we did all kinds of things together. It was lovely bonding. And at the end, When he was done, I said, okay, now, Michael, you've done it. And I gave him the $300 in cash. Here it is. Let's go buy a phone. And he looks at it, looks at me, looks at the money again. He says, Dad, I think we should put this in the bank. I just realized how hard it is to earn $300. I'd rather save this for something I really need than just getting a cell phone with it. And he didn't get one. Didn't get one, I think, until he was about 18. So this lovely sense of understanding that. And that's how I grew up all the time. You know, we never bought anything that wasn't on sale that we wanted, right? When we needed it, we needed it. But even the needs, I often think I want to write a book called Freezer Economics. And I just got rid of a freezer that I paid $300 for, again, the $300 number, when Marlene and I got married 36 years ago, and it just died 35 years later. Wow. And I did an estimate of how much that freezer saved me. And it was like $100,000. That freezer saved me $100,000 over 35 years. And I actually can calculate it by the year almost in terms of what we did and how we preserve, how we buy low and eat it when it's high, essentially. Mm-hmm. So we seldom buy things at the grocery store at cost. So that's just kind of how we worked. And that's how I ran my companies as well. Where we always figured out the spending, like the spending plan was more important to us than the revenue plan. If that makes sense. Yeah. Because we said, what do we want and what do we need?
Right.
And it's that differentiation is what makes it. And then donors, who give us money, it's the same thing. They see such value in working with us. And this is the other thing. We never lost a donor in the 20 years that I was at Tamarack. They all stayed with us that whole time. Which unprecedented. We're the only ones that any of them had ever done that with.
Wow.
And the other thing is that we also, when it came to that, we were never afraid to talk to them about money. We were never afraid of money. Mm-hmm. And so we had this wonderful relationship, and we loved all of our donors. We just loved them. Mm-hmm. And they knew that. They could feel that from us.
Yeah.
And so we created joy. And money wasn't about money. It was about life. It was about living. It was the necessity of life.
Right.
And it was a transaction that we made going through it. Anyway, that's how it was. And I've modeled that in my own life. And, It's been wonderful. I've been working for charities, but I've also on the side had stuff going on, and I've been really good at investing. And and so I didn't ever make a lot, but I ended up with more than enough.
Yeah, that's the key, is like, how much is enough? And so for many people, we don't understand that enough. What is enough? Like, we get bombarded by, well, you deserve this and you deserve that and da 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 da. I'm like, oh, you know, we're killing the planet by our idea of not knowing what is enough. So I'm
or our wants. Like, we have these weird wants, and the wants are, I don't think it's just fueled by advertising, because I'm bombarded by the same advertising as everybody else. We can blame it on them, but it's so easy to want things. And then we want instant gratification. And honestly, and now is a great time to ask me, as we're moving from a 2,600 square foot house to a 1,200 square foot condo, where did all this stuff come from? You know, and even for someone that lives as simply as we do, it's way too much, you know, and it's kind of like asking, I honestly believe that things don't bring happiness. I honestly believe that 90% of us believe that. And that simplifying our lives will always make us happier. And we all know that. Why is it so hard to do? you know?
Well, we moved from a 1500 square foot condo in Chicago to 820 square feet here.
There you go.
I love it. It's, I just feel like so happy, and I live, feel like I live in paradise, and it's a sweet place. And same thing. It's like, how much is enough?
Yeah.
And there's a way in which that when you simplify your life and you really go inside and say, what is enough? Everything shifts, because there's a sense of satisfaction and contentment in life. So when we come back, basically freedom. So when we come back, I'd like to kind of go a little bit more into the work you've done in poverty, and how, like, what is your definition of poverty, and like, how have you shifted people's lives around that? And then if we have time, you know, there's so much divisiveness in the planet right now, and your work on, in communities is really powerful. And I have hope for the future, basically, when we begin to come together in community.
Nice. Okay. I'm looking forward to, I'm going to geek you out a bit on my understanding of poverty and how we bring it to an end.
Yeah.
Particularly in North America.
Yeah. And particularly in America. So I was reading, it says, especially here in San Francisco, we live outside of San Francisco, but there's so many homeless people.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. It's a systemic problem. It's not a homeless problem.
No. And I'm going to talk about that too, because I don't think homelessness is about poverty.
No.
Poverty is one factor in homelessness, but there are many factors.
It's systemic. It's systemic.
Yeah. Well, but it's also personal.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about that when we come back.
Okay. So this is Cafe of Delights. I am your host, and I have Paul Bourne as my guest. And come on back, because we're having amazing conversations about many, many things.
Imagine if you were truly flourishing, how would your financial expansion impact the world? Author of Money Come Dance With Me, Gail West is an internationally known speaker, creative catalyst, and business intuitive at Success with Soul. Work with Gail to create a new relationship with money as your friend. Link the soul of your business to the business of your soul with programs like Sacred Money Mastery, Akashic Records of the Soul, and more. To receive a healing money meditation, go to successwithsoul.com today.
Cafe of Delight. Conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. Tune into TransformationTalkRadio.com every second and fourth Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific. We are at the precipice of one of the most exciting evolutions in human history. On Cafe of Delights, you will hear from those that are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. For more information on hope for a new reality, visit Gail West at SuccessWithSoul.com. Hi, we're back. I'm Gail West on the Cafe of Delights, and I have Paul Bourne, who's, we've been talking about money and poverty and community and many other things. So before we took a break, I was asking you about what's your definition of poverty, and what is your sense of how people have, that, like, how you've reduced poverty, and what is poverty? Let's go a little bit more into that.
Nice. Well, Gail, like, first of all, I don't have a definition, and that might seem surprising for someone who's worked in this all of his life. I remember a Rotary Club called me to a meeting and said that, you know, they didn't think that there was as many poor as people were saying. And I said, you're probably right. I said, but first of all, let me just ask you, what do you think? When do you think someone is poor? And they talked for a while, and they came back saying, well, if someone needs to beg for food, that's our definition of poverty. And I said, great. Why don't you then work to help 100 families stop needing to use the food bank? And they agreed, did it, which is just really interesting. So I think my definition of poverty is what it is to you. And it can mean many different things, and I don't want to argue about it. And that's what I say to the activists, because I'm anything but a poverty activist.
Right.
I believe that we can end poverty, and ending poverty is good for society. And if there's anything that drives me, given my history as a refugee and having my grandfathers executed, is I work toward peace in the world. And I believe that ending poverty is our number one, should be our number one peace strategy. And if you want to know how America could end poverty in its own country, is maybe spend as much as it does on poverty as it does on war. So anyway, I don't want to get into that. It's not my jurisdiction, but really, I think many people in the military, and I went to a military leadership school, so I know that many of them agree with me. So what we need to do is to create a more equitable society. And that equitable society works at a number of levels. I would say that poverty happens often, it's situational. Everybody who's poor has a story, and not any of those stories are equal. There are mistakes that people have made. They've been born into poverty. There's been a number of different reasons, lots of them, but that's why people are poor. People are often poor because they're elderly, because they're sick, because they're new, they're immigrants, and all of that. So that's one reason. It's situational, right? Another reason is that it's systemic.
Right.
And systemic in the sense that we allow corporations to pay low wages, right? We allow them to have split shift part-time, right? We allow them to not pay benefits, right? So all these things that if we put into play, right? You know, we charge for public transit. I'm going like, how, that's crazy. Why are our parks free? Why are our roads free? But we got to pay for public transit, which are mainly used by the poor.
Yep.
Why are we doing this? Right? It's our tax structure. Why are we letting some people become billionaires and other people live in poverty? And we tax them all, right? Not equally. I know people who make more pay more, but they should be paying a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. And I think these are just things that make sense. In every country that is voted the number one country in the world to live, they are better at this than they are in Canada, the United States. Right. That's what they've gotten good at, is working at some of these systemic things and just making it easier. Right. We should all be able to enjoy our city. We should have lots of open public spaces. Right. Parks, waterfronts, entertainment facilities, all that are able to anyone, regardless of income. That's what causes peace. When we don't fear each other. What everybody, regardless of income, is engaging and enjoying each other, right? And when we can create and make it easy to do the right thing. So that systemic work is part of it. So it's situational, it's systemic, right? And there are hardships that befall people, illness.
Right.
Illness causes a lot of poverty. And sometimes the illness is not just the individual who is ill with an addiction or whatever it might be, mental health issues, physical illness, but there's also community illness, you know, and I think you have some real problem areas in the United States where I once heard that in some of the slums in the U.S., your chance of dying before 21 was equal to dying in the battlefields of Vietnam. And that might age me, that example, but it's quite interesting what has occurred there.
Well, you know, I moved here from Chicago, and I know that in the South Side, in the West Side, there's a lot of despair. We were talking earlier about hope. As opposed to living in despair. And, you know, statistically, when you're in poverty, your ability to make, it's so stressful that your ability to make decisions that are, you know, what we would think of a rational decision is not there, because the brain is basically on hyper alert. It's always worried. There's stress that is so overwhelming that And there's a lot of anger and rage that comes with that, because we see, oh, I should want this and I should want that. And all these other people have this and I can't.
Exactly. But the other thing is that what's so interesting is that poverty can easily be ended.
Yeah.
And that's what we discovered. First of all, it is about communities having a vision and hope for ending poverty.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it starts, right? And with that vision and hope, they develop what we call a common agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring together the business sector, because we think business has a huge part to play in ending poverty. Government, because government has a huge part to play. The community sector, of course, all the community agencies that are often making lives better for the poor, they have a role to play in ending poverty as well. Not just helping the poor, but moving them out of poverty. And then people who are living in poverty themselves, they also need to learn a lot of the skills that are required, everything from financial literacy to just home skills like cooking and taking care of a household, and on and on. And so there's all these different factors. But when we create the will for that to begin to occur, it's a cycle that builds on itself. There's no magic formula. It's really about everyone pitching in. You know, in Des Moines, Iowa, it was so interesting. We were doing this work, and I didn't know it was the insurance capital of Canada, Des Moines, Iowa, of all places. And one of the insurance companies, very large, you know, they have these big call centers. They got involved in our campaign there. And one day we get an announcement from the CEO. They went from like an $8 or $9 wage, minimum wage in the company. And he just overnight said, from now on, it's a $15 minimum wage. And we're going to work more and more toward full-time employees. And that transformed not only his company, but all of his competitors. Right. So it's this interesting kind of thing that starts to happen when it becomes unacceptable. Right. So when business people start to believe, like Walmart, that they can provide the cheapest product to you, which we all appreciate, but not at the backs of the people who are working there. They pay the lowest wages. They used to, in Canada, they're not allowed to anymore. We outlawed it. But the split shift part-time. That means you go in for 2 hours when it's busy, you go home for 2 hours, and you come back for 2 hours when it's busy again. Well, who wants to do that, right? The bus drive is half your wages, right?
Well, it's the same as the people that create those products. I lived in China, and they make no money.
We don't want that.
So I'm curious how you get people to be willing to and want to engage in, or communities, how being willing to want to be engaged in this process of eliminating poverty.
Well, that's, again,
I gotta be willing.
Now that I have retired from Tamarack, I'm still doing work, a lot of volunteer work, but a lot of work with community groups still. But I wrote the book Breakthrough Community Change because the entire process that we use is in there. David Brooks has been a follower of our work. I know David Brooks from the New York Times, the writer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, he writes this quote, which I love. He says, Paul Boren, the head of the Institute, emphasizes that the crucial thing these community-wide collective impact structures do is change attitudes. In the beginning, it's as if everybody is swimming in polluted water. People are sluggish, fearful, isolated, looking only out for themselves. But when people start working together across sectors around a common agenda, it is like cleaning the water. You know, it's really, really interesting. Melody Barnes, who used to be President Barack Obama's head of the Domestic Policy Council. Matter of fact, I was lecturing at the Woodrow Wilson School for Scholars, and Melody invited me to come to the White House. It was a great honor for this immigrant Canadian to actually show up at the White House. I was walking with somebody. I didn't know where we were going. All of a sudden, I'm in front of the White House. I said, "What am I doing here?" He said, "Well, this is where Melody is." I said, "Who's Melody Barnes?" And we've had a friendship ever since, you know. And she says, you know, award-winning social entrepreneur Paul Bourne is one of the most creative anti-poverty leaders of his generation. In this new book, he shares his insights with organizations, equipping them to collaborate, change failing systems, and achieve impact at scale. But what I've learned in all of this work, it's not just about the individual work. We have to work at the systemic level. We're already working at the individual level and have amazing agencies helping people who are poor. But we need to start thinking about this systemically. So we need to get corporations to say, okay, we are a poverty-friendly corporation. That's what we used to call it, probably the best language. But what it meant is that there was no one living in poverty. And we asked them to monitor how many people are in your company that are living in poverty. And we gave them signs on the door that would say that they were poverty-free. I don't know, but I think an MBA school would kind of say that's not good business. Good business is you should do what's best for your shareholders. And I'm saying if your employees aren't your shareholders first, then who is? Right? Take care of them because you have a privilege of employing them. It's not the other way around, right? And I'm not saying that from a labor perspective or anything. I'm just saying it's true to form. Any good CEO in the world today will say what I'm saying. It's a privilege to have great employees, and those employees are what make the company successful. It's not the other way around. It's great to have great shareholders, and I'm going to maximize profits for them. Of course, we want to maximize profits, but the companies today that are most profitable are taking care of their employees. And so we want to change that system and that mindset and that thinking. And then from there, the government has a big role to play. In Canada, we wanted to eliminate child poverty, and so we invested in families that have children. And we give them the child tax benefit, right? The Canada Child Benefit, right? We want our seniors to have a good retirement. We have a very generous pension system, right? And the list goes on. And we say, oh, that's going to bankrupt our country. It doesn't bankrupt. It does quite the opposite. It stimulates the economy.
So that's we could go on and on and on.
We could.
But
I'm a bit like I'm behind.
Yeah, I know. So Paul Bourne, how do people contact you? How do they know about you? Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, you could just go to my website, paulbourne.ca, paulbourn.ca. And then you can learn more just about me. It's kind of the easiest way, and all my books are there. You can just Google me on Amazon. I'm pretty much in every one of your bookstores. Two of my books are already bestsellers. So it's exciting to see that. I work with Barrett Kohler and Penguin Books. So the books are everywhere. Yeah. On my website, you'll have my contact information, and I write blogs and all those sorts of things as well. But yeah. So
Thank you
yes.
so
Please,
much,
please be in
Paul.
touch.
It was lovely to have you. What a gift. What a gift you are to the world. And kind. Your kindness radiates.
Thanks, Gail. Yours too. What a joy to talk about this and talk about money, and good luck with your show as it continues to grow.
Thank you. Thank you.
All the best in your work.
Okay. This is Gail West and Cafe of Delights. Thank you for tuning in to Cafe of Delights, conversations that enlighten and inspire with me, your host, Gail West. Listen or watch live every second and fourth Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific on transformationtalkradio.com for a series of riveting interviews from those who are actively working at the edges of local, regional, and global transformation. From science to spirituality, culture, arts, and new economies, and more, we will explore how to create a world where all can thrive. For more information on hope for a new reality, visit me, Gail West, at successwithsoul.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.